Welcome to the Boston College Chief Executives Club podcast of the September 1, 2020 forum featuring David Taylor, Chair, President, and CEO of Procter & Gamble. I'm Warren Zola. The Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management, is one of the top-ranked CEO speaking forums in the world. Several times each year, Boston's business leaders gather to learn from CEOs of global companies, leaders from the top echelons of their fields who welcome the opportunity to address an audience of their peers. David Taylor joined us for a series we call Conversations with CEOs as he spoke with our executive director, Warren Zola, and engaged in Q&A with our members. The conversation focused on Procter & Gamble's response to COVID-19, changes in the supply chain, diversity and inclusion, and their incredible dedication to research and development. Please enjoy this podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club. On behalf of Boston College and the Carroll School of Management, welcome to the kickoff event of the 2020-2021 season for us. As you all know, we are thrilled to welcome Chairman, President, and CEO of Procter & Gamble, Mr. David Taylor. So, David, thank you again so much for joining us today.
Happy to be here. Look forward to the conversation and the questions.
Wonderful. So before I start with my first question or two, I want to sort of go through the ground rules for everybody who's here. Again, for the CEO Club, this is our first webinar instead of Zoom meeting. And so we're going to try, the scheduling should be the same, but our protocol will be slightly different. David and I will have a conversation that should last around 30 minutes. At around 12:30, we will open it up to Q&A from our members. Please post questions either in the Q&A feature or feel free to post them in the chat. I will then call upon our members to join us. I'll call your name. I will then, with luck, if I don't screw things up here and shut the meeting down, ask you to unmute your mic. Wait a second, make sure you're unmuted. Ask your question, put yourself back on mute, and listen to David's response. We will continue till about 1:10. I'll do a lightning round of questions where we'll ask David some really insightful questions. We'll finish with his message of hope, and we will wrap up at 1:15, something we are known to doing promptly. So that's the plan moving forward. But really, let's turn to our guest. David, you grew up in North Carolina, attended Duke University. And as far as I could tell from there, you joined Procter & Gamble. You're now celebrating your 40th year with the company. Is that accurate?
Yes, that is. Yes, P&G started in 1980 for a little over 40 years.
So just getting the hang of it, right?
Yeah, it's a good start.
Yeah. I mean, I came to Boston College in 1991, and there's times when I feel like I'm still a rookie just learning my way around it. And you know, for those of you who don't know, I'm here in my office at Boston College. Classes started yesterday. I teach this afternoon. We are full go here on campus. And if you hear noise outside, it's probably the students who are excited about the beginning of the semester. Let me start. I'll get into some specific questions about P&G and what you guys have been doing. But let's just start about the last 6 months. How has this pandemic affected your company, what you're doing for business over the past 6 months? What does it mean for both you as a CEO, but also for P&G?
First thing, we had kind of a lead warning in that the second biggest market for our company is China. And so we saw the big impact that happened, frankly, right at the beginning of February when they didn't let businesses open up after Chinese New Year. For us, we collapsed kind of all the work into three very simple priorities. We've set them constantly since literally mid-February, and that is keep employees safe and our workplaces safe. Number two, make, pack, and ship the consumer products that consumers buy. 5 billion consumers will buy a P&G brand this year. So make, pack, and ship. Number three, help our communities. And we've done things like face shields for many of the hospitals actually in Boston, along with masks and sanitizer, other things that we don't normally make. We could repurpose some of our equipment, and we started doing that. So those three things, and that hasn't changed. And it's been amazing how it's focused everybody. Keep people safe, make, pack, ship, help your community. And within that, to me, then there's certainly a business strategy that's overlaid on that. But those three things have driven almost everything we've done. And many of the other things that you do, we'd say that has to step aside to those three things. And that's helped us because it's been the rallying cry within our company. We've been very consistent, and I don't think that'll change until there's a vaccine and we're in a very different environment.
And so it seems like that focus, I've heard that several times from CEOs over the past several months or the summer, that they need to be laser focused on sort of number one, understanding their role as a CEO. I mean, you have what, 100,000 employees?
100,000.
Over 100 sites that you are manufacturing. And so that responsibility must fall heavy on your shoulders and sort of keep you up at night. But also clearly you guys have been doing a great job.
One of the things that we looked very early on is we don't want, obviously, anybody to get ill, and we want to help our employees. So on the first priority, which is protecting the health and safety of all our employees in the workplaces, there were a number of things that we said we will do early on. Before it was clear that this thing was going to run around the world, when it was even still in China, it became difficult to get masks. And when some of our employees said, we think we can access some mask-making machines. So we said, order them. And the idea was, let's protect what it takes to protect our people. Today, we have 12 masks running, I think 12 to 16 mask machines all around the world. We make millions of masks a month to outfit all our employees. We started sending them to families, our employees' families, to say, because if your family's not safe, one, it's going to affect your life, and we care about the families of our employees, but also it'll affect what you bring in. And then we've said, then we can go further, and we've donated millions of masks. But it's been, it really starts with, you can keep your people safe. And a company like P&G that's largely a promote from within company, it is a very strong culture. And to me, that causes all of us to believe and frankly, to be willing to do the extra things on make, pack, ship to support the business, because we know the company's got our back. And we've told anybody around the world, if you're not comfortable coming in, you've got an elderly parent at home or something else that creates a high risk for you, we allow them to stay home and we maintain benefits. We want literally all of our people to be safe. And we believe there's enough that can operate to operate our company. And we have.
And when have you started to, when have you started to, you think that your employees will actually be coming back into the office? Is that something you've put off in the future or summer coming in or this rotating? How are you addressing that?
It varies by country. Our employees in China are back in the office. All of our plants are operating. All 110 plants are operating today. The vast majority of 24 hours, 7 days a week. All of our distribution centers are running. All of our development centers are up and running, but they may be at, say, 50% capacity, depending on the spacing that we're able to enable. And then the offices in Europe are probably up to 40% occupancy. In the U.S., it varies to whatever municipality they're in on what the conditions are there. So, for instance, in Boston, the Gillette organization, that decision will be made by Gary Kuhn, who is our CEO of the Gillette business in Boston. In Cincinnati, I'm in the office right now, but we probably have 10% in the office because for a while, Ohio was at a higher rate than the threshold. So we told everybody the offices are open, the offices are safe. Everybody, including me, except for I just took it off right before we started. Yep. I came in with the mask. I would be wearing a mask as soon as I leave this conference room where the door's closed. But we said it's optional, so it's probably 10% here. And we'll make the decision periodically. We revisit those decisions. And I'd say broadly in the U.S., we're probably at 20, 25% occupancy.
Yeah, that seems pretty standard. And, here at BC, we're about the same. Yesterday, like I said, it was the first day of classes. I had to walk through the quad briefly, just sort of enjoying everyone back. And it was remarkable in terms of the students were all there and almost every single person was wearing a mask.
Good.
And it's the new normal, right? And so thinking about when I leave this closed door, I've got the same thing. I've got a mask. I was tested. I've got a band I'm supposed to wear around campus. And so, we're abiding by science and then hoping that at some point we'll figure this out. So let's shift gears a little bit. Obviously, P&G is probably best known for brand management and excellence. About 5 or 6 years ago, you shed about 100 brands in an effort to focus on the highest return brands. And the decision seems to have worked well for you. What was your approach to this in managing and building sort of the great brands that you have now?
The effort was to try to identify those brands or categories that we believe didn't play best to our strengths and capabilities. Mm-hmm. Over the course of probably 20 years, we'd acquired a number of businesses, plants, and brands. We were up to close to 200 at our peak. And the choice was to go down to from about 16 categories to the 10 core categories from 170-80 brands to today's 65 to 70, but preserve the vast majority of the profit and the vast majority of the sales. And that's what we've done. And the principle we used is we wanted to be biased toward daily use categories mm-hmm. where performance drives brand choice. And that is a really critical statement, where performance drives brand choice. For instance, we sold a number of the beauty businesses like CoverGirl Cosmetics mm-hmm. to Coty. And those businesses, we believe in many cases, the purchase decision was often made by a celebrity endorsement or look of the season, but we call it kind of fad, fashion, flavor type drivers versus science. You know, a laundry detergent, you can prove whether it's more effective on addressing stains. You can show science-based tests on virtually all of our products. And the idea was we want to be categories where you can tell a difference. You can tell a difference if you use a Bounty paper towel versus a private label paper towel. The strength, the absorbency is meaningfully different. And there's a reason it is the largest by a factor of 4 over any other brand in the United States, because it's meaningfully better. Each one of those machines that makes it is in hundreds of millions of dollars. It's a very technically advanced process. And the idea was if we can play in those categories, we can develop a level of superiority and performance that then we can sustain over time. Categories that didn't fit that, we figured we're best owned by somebody else. And so we went down to the 10 core categories, and certainly we've had to me a sequential progress over the last several years post that decision.
And it seems to me, in terms of looking at P&G from the outside, your focus on brands has been incredibly valuable and seems to be the right decision back then, but you're also investing heavily in innovation and thinking about the role that innovation plays with R&D and what you're trying to do. How does it give you guys a market advantage in that realm?
Yeah, the strategy that we've been very open with investors is based on just a few key points. And beyond the three priorities right now that are in the COVID world, the ones that will last for many years and we've had for the last several years is we wanted to have a portfolio of daily use brands where performance drives brand choice. Then the next fundamental choice is we want to be meaningfully superior in product, package, go-to-market capability, communication, call it brand equity, and value, consumer and customer. And to do that, we need to have a level of innovation across product, package, go-to-market, communication, and value that is meaningfully different than our competitors. And in R&D, we have 1,000 PhDs within P&G working on meaningfully making each one of those brands that you buy today meaningfully better. We have then below the after superiority was a level of productivity across every element of our cost pool. And then an organization change where everybody's empowered, agile, and to me accountable for outcome results. And the change we made is to go to a much more decentralized design, to be much more agile in marketplaces around the world. And that's really caused us to speed up the pace of both innovation and decision-making. And then we adopted one other thing which really worked, which is this choice to say we want to constructively disrupt everything we do on a regular basis, because if we don't, somebody else will to us. And if somebody does it, it's a disruption. If we do it, it's constructive disruption, because we have an eye on how we can create value for the many stakeholders that depend on our company. And to me, that's worked. And starts, though, with we have to have a meaningfully better product. One, if you used it, and then I took it away and gave you another product and you used it, you would want to go back because you could tell a performance difference. If not, why, it doesn't justify any price premium. And what we've seen over time is consumers are reaching for trusted brands that deliver on the core benefit of the category.
And again, it's been this perfect combination of trusted brands with proven results, statistically and scientifically proven, and then the continuing to invest in R&D for the innovation to make sure that you're ahead of the game and your competition. And I think it's clear to those of us who are the consumers that when you see a P&G product, you know what you're getting. Obviously, in the past decade, retail has changed quite a bit.
Yes.
And you've talked to us a little bit about sort of P&G's sort of role in there, but what do you see coming down the pike in terms of the retail and P&G's role in it moving forward?
Retail's gone through tremendous transformation, and you've seen, and we've all read, the number of companies that haven't been able to make the pivot and have gone out of business. The online marketplace, e-commerce, has had an enormous difference even in our categories. It's disrupted some other categories even more. Our strategy is we're agnostic. We want to be available wherever the shopper wants to shop, the consumer wants to shop. And I think what we're going to see in the retail world, and we're seeing it, is a huge growth in not only e-com, but omni-retailers. And you've seen folks, the big retailers like a Walmart or Target, embrace the fact that there's many different ways they have to be available to their shoppers. The same with some of the food chains. Kroger is based here in Cincinnati, and they very much embraced it. They want to say, whether you want to buy it online, whether you want to buy it online and have us deliver it, whether you want to buy it online, have it come by and pick it up in the store, whether you want to go in the store, you pick any of a number of ways, and we need to create a business model that allows us to do that profitably. And then the retailer pivots to the manufacturer and says, you play a role. We need products and packages and programs that allow us to achieve that outcome. Because at the end of the day, what a retailer, virtually every retail CEO I've talked to would say, one of the core objectives we have, or expectations we have of you, if you want to be a preferred supplier, you need to grow the category. I don't care whether you gain share and you and your competitor trade it. That does nothing for me. Your innovation needs to bring more shoppers in and cause them to invest more dollars in the category. So grow the category, need to grow my penny profit or margin. And if you do those two things, then I'll support your brands. If you don't, I'll look elsewhere. And the demands on them on profitability have gone up tremendously. So we have worked. When I said there's five elements of superiority, one of them was value, consumer and customer. It is our job at P&G to approach our major customers and say, here is the plan to grow the category and to grow your business with us, including your margin. And that means we need to have programs that do so. Absent that, we won't earn their support. And for a company that's been around 183 years, people worry about the quarter. I'm worried about a year, 5 years, 10 years, because that's, to me, the time frame for P&G has got to be much broader, which means we have to earn the customer support, not for a day or a month, but over the course of many, many years. And it's got to be in their self-interest to support P&G.
So and that certainly makes sense to me in terms of how things have been changing out in the retail space and world, and to think about P&G's role there. We've talked a little bit about sort of strategy. I'd like to shift now to talk a little bit about sort of what we've called, I don't know, the pandemic within the pandemic over the past summer. Carol Fulp used that term, one of our members of Fulp Diversity, talking about sort of racial equality, diversity, inclusion, and clearly what's happened over the past 6 months or even longer, several years, has put a sharper focus on companies and how they address and handle racial and gender equity, diversity, inclusion. I'll start with sort of a simple softball question for you, but P&G has more female inventors than any other company in the U.S. Was this a deliberate goal? If so, take credit for it. If not, tell us how it happened.
It is a deliberate goal to have women at 50% of any level of achievement in our company. And if you look right now at our R&D organization, I give Kathy Fish, our chief R&D officer, a lot of credit. She's done a beautiful job over a number of years that she's led it, along with her predecessors, is we've invested in and developed all of our scientists and inventors. And so when I saw that statistic, it was thrilling to me, because it indicates that the development program over many years that many other people have invested in has worked. You know, if you look at our board of directors, we're 50% women, 50% men. And you go through the organization, we're working hard to get there. We're not there on every level, but we're, I think, 48% of our managers worldwide, including areas where there is a heavily dominant male culture in terms of the societal norms. We average 48% women on our path to 50, and we're trying to get to 50-50 throughout. We know we will be a better company, better able to serve the consumers when we get there. I also believe consumers more and more want to know the values of the companies behind the brands they purchase. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the reasons we've embraced a very broad view of diversity. We believe we need to accurately reflect the broad range of humanity in our advertising and do it in a respectful way. And I hope folks have seen both the way we advertise, who we show in our advertising, we're working on who's behind the camera. We want a diverse crowd behind the camera, not just the typical folks. We've been very demanding to our agencies where there may be heavily male-dominated directors or other producers and say, we want to see people of color. We want to see a broad range of diversity. And to me, that's one of the ways we can use both our voice, but also our spending power to role model.
And as we all know, there's a difference between diversity and inclusion. And I saw an interview that you gave recently where you mentioned that companies are making strides in diversity, but the harder part is in creating that inclusive environment. And so what is it that either you are doing, but also what are some of the steps that are actionable that all of our members, we now have, you know, 80, I think we have 90 people listening to this talk, almost all of whom except me are running, you know, major organizations and companies themselves. What sort of advice can you give them and us about how to be more inclusive?
Just many comments, an area that I'd be happy to talk at length because I believe so strongly in it. Diversity is about having a broad range of people around you. And certainly my team is a very diverse team. And there's a fundamental belief that it will give you better results because, and I'll start with just why I believe that, which is I'm a big believer in integrative thinking, which is if you and I have a trusting relationship and I can surround myself with people that have all kinds of differences, when someone disagrees with me or has a different point of view, instead of trying to win the argument, if I walk down their ladder of inference, I see they accessed different experiences and knowledge. If I can access that, then the more diverse team I have around me, the broader range of information I have, and therefore, frankly, the field of vision gets much broader. That's if you have a diverse team. In order to get to that information, you have to create an environment where people feel they can be authentic and that they will open up and have a trusting relationship with you. And to me, that's, I believe, is the harder part. Many diverse teams perform poorly because they're not really a team. It's a diverse group of people where either level dictates what happens or any of a number of other things versus the merit of the idea. We start with a deep-seated belief in an individual and the individual's ability to contribute. Every single individual we hire at P&G goes through, to me, a very rigorous process. They're all achievement-oriented people. Any bias that we see showing up, we interpret that as things that exist in our system that we need to address. And to me, that helps us. In terms of creating an inclusive environment, it starts with one, the leader has to believe it. If the leader doesn't believe it, to me, I need to replace the leader. And I've got many examples of where folks had written off a group of people, and whether it's black, white, male, female, or I've heard often people will take folks that have been in roles for a long time and say they're kind of, you know, David, they're continuity people that I'm not putting them in leadership positions. And the action I take when I hear that is replace the leader. Every single individual, if you expect people to contribute at a high level and create an environment where they have the support, generally, my experience has been they step up to do so. And I've lived 8 different places. I've lived in Asia and Europe, and I have not seen an exception where if you start with a group of high achievement people and have both the expectation and are willing to make the investment. The other thing is that's the point that I made before, inclusive environments don't seek to win arguments. They seek to get to the best outcome. It's not about who is right in an inclusive culture. It's about doing what's right. And that's hard because most of us like to be right. And to me, one of the first things we had to get over, if we really want an inclusive environment, is to say that the benefit is getting to a better outcome versus being right. And leaders, especially in certain cultures, want to be right. And to me, that shuts down to me, the inclusive culture, because then people default to a hierarchy-driven decision-making system.
And so how do you, I mean, I love this topic in general, but and I think what you're saying all makes sense to me, but how do you teach or how do you expect employees to learn how to listen, right? So we all talk about the best idea wins and we can you know, have a meeting and be respectful, but how do you get people to listen to others' ideas and say, you know what, that wasn't mine, but that's the best idea. Let's move forward with that and be respectful with differing opinions, because I think that's something that's sorely lacking in business, in our society and country lately. How do we get people to listen more?
It's a hard one. It is a skill one can teach. And frankly, we have a variety of what we call internal colleges at every level where we teach a lot of these skills, whether it's decision-making, but even listening. And it's interesting. There's a little quip that I heard that I really believe. most people interpret listening as waiting to speak. They're formulating their response to what's going to happen next, what they want to say next. So their mind is focused on that versus truly trying to understand, which is why the example that I gave, if you have a different point of view, instead of whose idea is better, let me understand why you have a different idea. And out of that, there's a fairly good chance there's something I didn't take into consideration to formulate my opinion. And let's get to a better third way. And then we both win because the outcome's the best. And it's not about being right or having the best idea. We want the best outcome. And one of the things that I really do believe, in many cases, people bring these great skills to our company. I say, I love that you've got great skills and great education. And what I pay for is applied skills. And so if you want to make them turn into meaningful results in our company, most cases you have to connect and work with and through other people. And to do that, you've got to create both a relationship and an ability to tap into the skills they have. And to me, it's one of the greatest strengths of our company is our talent development system. And, and there's probably some people even on this call that had a background in P&G. You look at the number of CEOs, CFOs, and C-suite people across corporate America that spent some meaningful part of their time at P&G. It's because we really do believe from the day you walk in to the day you retire, you ought to be being developed. I'm right now taking an online college course with a group of people in the area that I need to build greater skills on disruptive innovation.
I mean, that's great. I mean, that's, you know, we talk about that at the business school at Boston College all the time in terms of, you know, here's the skills that you need to know, right? You need to have a foundation in accounting and marketing and finance and all those things. But it's that collaborative process. It's learning how to be effective and apply those skills to help your company sort of move forward. And so I think that that really resonates. And, you know, you're right. I mean, I can't tell you the number of business case studies and examples that we got, like, oh, let's now take a look at how Procter & Gamble did X, Y, and Z. And I'm dating myself. That would have been 30 years ago, I guess now, going through an MBA program. So
I'm glad to hear that. I also believe one of the things about inclusion, one of the many things I've seen to really help is, and there's a variety of different techniques, but there's this pairs type session that we have with some individuals, which you ask somebody, how do I help you be at your best? Not, let me tell you what I need from you. Let me understand from your vantage point what my role can be to increase your contribution to the company and how do you want to work? And to me, those that do that and do that with all their direct reports to me are much more able to create an inclusive environment because there's two technologies to figure out things. You can ask or guess. Many of us guess. They just assume on the way they've done it in the past. And to me, those that truly want to build an inclusive team, invest time in it and build relationships.
I think that's a great, it's a great point. And B, I think it's a great stopping point for me to open it up to our members now to ask some questions. We're at the bottom of the hour. I'm going to go to Ed Pendergast first. Ed, I'm going to, if I don't, again, cancel the entire meeting, I'm going to allow you to talk. Hopefully your audio will come on and you can ask your question of David.
Fascinating, David, and I appreciate you doing this. I'm fascinated by the supply chain, and it still is screwed up. When I go to a grocery store, they always have at least two or three products that I cannot get. Sometimes they have a substitute, sometimes they don't. And what I question is, when, if ever, do you think the supply chain generally will get back into what we used to think of as normal?
And it's certainly, the observation is very fair. And if I kind of separate two things, there's the COVID world and there's the pre or post COVID world. In the COVID world, frankly, P&G and myself, we're guilty of having some of the empty shelves. It's been widely reported, you know, bath tissue and paper towel are two of the items that we can go in store. But it's because the category grew and is growing 25 to 30%. And most of the manufacturers don't keep that much capacity idle. So there's the COVID spike, which I think you're going to live with outages for a while because many companies, including our own, is not going to invest hundreds of million of dollars for capacity that'll come on in 3 years that won't be needed when it comes on. Having said that, I think there has been across industry a choice to bring inventories down because of cash flow reasons, and both the retailers and manufacturers across a wide range of industries to me have gotten very, very lean. And what that does mean is any kind of disruption can put a spike in the system, and then you know, you as a consumer may be disappointed when you go to shelf. We're working very hard, and frankly, we have the benefit now of just a lot of data where we can look and try to understand what we need to do throughout our whole supply chain to make sure that we get up to what we would like to be up in the 99% reliable, notwithstanding something like the pandemic that puts huge spikes in supply and sometimes some issues in the supply chain. I do believe that the expectation of individuals, especially in a world of e-commerce, are only going up on when they expect to have things available. And manufacturers like P&G have to be ready to have it generally within 24 hours to a retailer. And the retailer's got to get it in some cases less than 24 hours to a consumer. And we are redesigning our supply chain to have late stage differentiation and other capabilities closer to retailers, at least in large countries, U.S., China, and most of continental Europe.
I find it fascinating to follow up on his question, though, to walk the supermarket and to just see what shelves today are empty. Because it's been sort of this rotating, you know, at the beginning there was, you know, tissues and toilet paper and all that sort of stuff. But now there's sort of this variance of products that I can't quite understand. And I know it's supply chain, but it's just fascinating to me to sort of, you know, walk as a consumer, but thinking about why, going through the grocery store, not just, you know, telling my mom, geez, I'm really sorry, I couldn't get X for you today. They didn't have it.
Yeah, I think the data that I have, which I can go across quite a few categories because just the footprint of our company, we have categories that versus a base period, call it an undisturbed 3 months before COVID, yep, we have some categories indexing 90, so 10% down, and some categories indexing 130 or more, and in some weeks, 150. And the supply chain can handle the 90 pretty easy. It yep. can handle a 105, a 10% increase. In many categories, there's not 30 or 40% available extra capacity. And what has happened is, and some people say, but David, that doesn't make sense. People aren't consuming more bath tissue than they did before. They're just going somewhere differently. The issue is there's different products sold in the away from home market and the retail market. Retail market generally has a higher quality. And what we don't even supply the away from home market. We only make for the retail market. So we don't have capacity that we can repurpose. Some do. And that's true of many categories. We've seen huge disruptions in consumption in many categories. And many companies, including our own, did not anticipate this level of a spike. We haven't seen it in 40 years, this level of a spike. And we'll adjust as best we can, and other manufacturers will as well.
Yeah, Ramon Lagarda from Pepsi will be joining us on October 2nd.
And yeah, I know Ramon well.
Well, fantastic. We're very much looking forward to him. And I think Mike White, who is on the board there from formerly DirecTV and Boston College Board of Trustees, is here as well today. So, hi, Mike. Great. Thanks for joining us. But I found it sort of interesting. I was walking through the soda aisle, and to figure out which bottles of either Pepsi or Coke products that they make were now no longer available. And I was trying to figure out why. I'm like, you know, everyone's still drinking, you know, diet yeah. root beer first. And it was like, well, because it was fountain versus bottle. So again, you know, just as a consumer, I'm sort of fascinated by that. And it is supply chain.
It is. It's one of the parts that many manufacturers, including ours, have made choices to reduce the number of items, SKUs yep. that we make in order to increase the total capacity. So if we made 40 versions of something, if we can make 15 of the most popular, we can increase the total output. But it means the people that wanted those 25, other ones won't find them. And that's very true right now. Many companies have gone to reduced lineups to increase capacity.
Which is why so many of us, when we find that marginal product that we like, but apparently the masses don't, we've begun hoarding. And so I will not show you what
too.
My basement looks like of products that I'm scared silly will not be there. But let's turn back to our members. Joanne, Simons, I am going to, with luck, unmute you. You are up next with David Taylor.
Oh, David, I want to just thank your company, P&G, for being a leader. I think maybe the first company to feature children with disabilities in your advertising. And this kind of leadership has had an enormous benefit to further inclusion in our country and around the world. And I was hoping that you could use your status and your success and encourage those companies whose boards you sit on to do the same and follow your leadership.
Well, thank you for that. And certainly I will do that, in that I very much believe that we want to tap into, frankly, all the people that are available to us to both serve in terms of products, but also recognize and feature. And you'll see in our advertising, and just as I mentioned earlier, you'll see in who we work with. We both hire a broad range of people. We've hired a number of people. We have an organization inside our company of the people with disabilities. And frankly, they bring tremendous capabilities. And what we try to do is find ways that best match the skills and capabilities they have to work that we have. And also, we try to represent them in our advertising in a way that recognizes, to me, the humanity in everybody. So I thank you for that. I'll continue to do that. Our company will continue to do that. And we've tried to use our voice. I don't know if many of you have seen, there's three films that we developed recently over the course of the last 3 years. A lot of this was before the recent awful events that have happened, but it's called The Talk, one's called The Look, and one's called The Choice, that are meant to prompt dialogue that just elevates, to me, the understanding that all of us have on the significant inequalities that exist and frankly, the very difficult challenges many people of color face in our country. And the idea is not to blame anybody, but it's just to highlight what's real. It's reflecting the, frankly, reality in the United States. And then we hope is that the dialogue prompts understanding, and understanding leads us to a better place.
Yeah, and I'm looking through the comments, the Q&A, sorry. And Juan Alexander Concepcion, who's a friend and alum, and again, a member of the board here of trustees, points out the talk and the look and how well received and applauded those have been from those who value diversity and inclusion and rejecting, I'll quote Juan, racial separation and antagonism. So he says kudos. And he's interested in sort of what prompted you to target those efforts specifically a little bit more than what you said. And then I will go to Larry Gulko for his next question.
Yeah, the reason, and we've done, frankly, first, the talk was the first one we did. And while it was modestly well-received at first, we got a lot of attacks. And what it illustrated was just we are right now, to be very divided on things that, frankly, we shouldn't be. In many ways, what we wanted to do was to feature a very real conversation that occurs in countless African-American families today on a talk that parents have with children. And it's something we heard. We do a lot of observational research in homes, and we heard this many, many times. And we said part of what we want to do is reflect reality and then learn from it. We played that film, and it elicited a strong response, both pro and con. And we tried to work through that. It also elicited a response within our company. It prompted some really good open dialogue and people had a chance to have a safe forum to talk about what it is like. And to me, it's been eye-opening and powerful to happen inside our community, and we wanted to share that more broadly outside the walls. The look is also very reflective of reality for many, many African-American, especially African-American men. And then the last one, the choice, that one was prompted by just the reality of what's happened around us. And to me, we do all have a choice. You know, not being racist is one thing, but being against racism and using whatever personal power you have to make a positive contribution, to me, is needed in our country to heal it and to move forward where everybody gets lifted up.
Well, based on the feedback that I've gotten before this session and doing research and from our members who are sort of chatting and putting questions up here, I think that those messages have resonated tremendously well with many of us. And so I do thank you for that and happy to see that continue. Next up with a question is, looks like Larry Gulko. So Larry, I'm going to unmute you and we will go from there.
Great. David, welcome to Boston. Warren, thank you. David, we have a mutual acquaintance with Ed Bastian, one of the amazing leaders in this country. And I want to ask you, because I was with Ed a little while ago, and I'm talking about purpose-driven brands. Like I know, like Delta, they have 90,000 employees. They pay them one day off a year to go to the community and help out. I know the Delta execs sleep with the homeless. I know they're probably one of the biggest drivers of blood to the Red Cross. So they're doing really good. And I want to ask you, in the time of the pandemic, what is P&G doing as a good citizen, brand-driven. And again, I'm not implying a PG, but some companies do like these little stints, a PR stints, but they're not really a part of the DNA of the culture. So can you share with us what P&G is doing as far as being, as far as doing good, being a great brand citizen, you know, to the community, to those in need, you know, because I really believe that after the pandemic is over, those companies that really showed their culture and DNA are going to be rewarded with a lot of loyalty because they just did the right thing.
I could not agree with you more. And it's been part of the social fabric of our company for the entire time I've been with the company. My first year with the company 40 years ago, I was encouraged to participate in a number of community activities. We are and have been, I'll take Cincinnati as an example, the number one contributor to United Way. This year, I'm the campaign chair for the city of Cincinnati. Of the $50 million we're trying to raise, P&G, one company, will likely be about 20%. Last year, we were 10 of the $49 million raised in Cincinnati. And it's true of many of the different things, and both the corporate gift, but also the generosity of P&G people, because we believe strongly, if you're in a community, you ought to make it better. If you touch it, you make it better. In the pandemic, it illustrated it because employees initiated the idea to, can we go get mask equipment when it was evident that it was going to be difficult to get? We had an employee in our Lima plant in Ohio, an employee group, say we can repurpose our perfume making equipment and turn it into making hand sanitizer. We've given tens of thousands of liters of hand sanitizer to a number of organizations. In Boston, our Gillette organization took the packaging that you see on razors and said, we can make those into face shields, and the Boston hospitals are short on face shields. And so they converted equipment. We've given hundreds of thousands of face shields away, both there that we've made, but also in a Cincinnati development line that got repurposed to be able to make those. We had an entrepreneur approach us that was working on a low-cost ventilator. We funded it and then loaned some of our engineers to it. All of these are not businesses we're in. They're there because we need to respond to the community. We had three priorities: keep our people safe, make, pack, ship, and contribute to the community. And that's been true for the entire time I've been with P&G. In a pandemic, or frankly in a hurricane, you'll see the tide loads of hope. We're down there washing people's clothes and helping in ways that we can with donated product. We've given away tens of millions of dollars of free product, not just here, but around the world, because we do believe those that have need to contribute in ways that they're able. So I applaud what you say. My hope and belief is all companies can. I think business is the greatest positive force for change available in the world today. And Delta Airlines and Ed Bastian are fabulous role models. They've done a beautiful job to me and have over time. My father-in-law worked for Delta for over 50 years. So I've seen Delta from the day I met my wife, you know, up through, he died many years ago, but it's one of the reasons that the Delta board was very attractive to me. I've been around that company for most of my adult life, and they're a fine company, and Ed is an outstanding leader.
Yeah, we're big fans of Ed's. You mentioned Gillette, and obviously that's a huge brand and company here in Boston. I'm going to turn to Jerry Denterline, who's got a question about Gillette, and I will let her ask it. So, Jerry, I'm going to unmute you, I think, and you can ask your question.
Hi there. I'm Jerry Denterline, and I am a native Cincinnatian. My mother used to say, among the working class and middle class people of Cincinnati, there are a lot of P&G millionaires because they bought P&G stock. I guess Nelson Peltz would like there to be more, but let's leave that aside for now. I wonder, when you look back on the Gillette merger, and my dad would send me press clips, and I remember from the Enquirer saying, Oral-B, meet Crest. And I wonder what went well in that merger, and what benefits looking back so many years later, and what were the challenges?
It's a great question. And just one comment, you mentioned Nelson Peltz. Just for everybody that's listening, Nelson and I get along great. You haven't heard him say a negative word about P&G for several years now. And to me, it illustrated an important point. And then I will get to the question on Gillette, which is once we made the choice to bring him on the board, we asked him to work on behalf of the company. And we said, we would treat you as a full board member and build a relationship with him. And we've both done that, and the board's done that. And Nelson's one of our biggest advocates today. He had things to contribute. We had things that we know we needed to do. We weren't going to move from our values and did not throughout the entire time, but we were able to listen, and over time got to a good place. On the Gillette merger, Gillette was, it, to me, it's a fabulous business. It's a beautiful brand that was built over many decades, going back you know, to the previous century, even back to whatever the late 1800s. What went well is we got, from P&G's vantage point, some outstanding brands in Gillette and Oral-B. The people that we brought on were great. The capability in Boston is terrific. I've been to the manufacturing plant and the World Shaving headquarters many times. So people, technology, brand equity, all very good, and we're happy with that. Oral-B has been a great addition to our oral care business, and the Oral-B power business is growing very nicely and has for several years. One of the things that we got hurt on, and you saw, for those that follow us closely, we had an $8 billion write-down of goodwill last year on Gillette, is Gillette is a very global footprint, and we got hit very badly with foreign exchange. The $8 billion, almost all of it was due to foreign exchange hurts. We have a very large business in Russia. When the ruble goes from 30 to a dollar to 60 to a dollar, we have half the size of business, and you have to price up, and then you get into share issues. We had the same issue in Brazil. Is another very large business, 85, 90 share in Brazil of the men's shaving business. So the share position is strong. The business is strong. It's had some meaningful challenges. There's a number of online companies that have popped up. But interestingly, those that popped up and got a lot of fanfare, you fast forward 2 to 3 years and Gillette is growing share again. Why? Over time, performance matters. Gillette is the best performing razor in the world, and Gillette serves consumers across the full price ladder. In the short run, people can come in and claim a number of things, but over time, men and women will go to products that deliver meaningful benefits, and Gillette and the Gillette family of brands have done that. So we're optimistic about the future. It was challenging, especially during the period where the dollar weakened considerably, given our Gillette is a very global business. We believe we've got great brands, and we believe there's a lot we can do. We just launched a new line called the King C. Gillette Beard Line to recognize that while the societal trend is more facial hair, design products that help you trim and meet the needs of people with facial hair. And so there's the King C. Gillette line that's now launching and off to a great start, but from the Gillette company.
That's great. Gillette is such an important brand here in Boston and New England, obviously. I don't know if Jonathan or Robert Kraft have joined us. They typically do or going to. And obviously they have played a role in Gillette's in the stadium, partners. Obviously. And so yes. On behalf of them, I guess I'll thank you. I'm going to turn now to Diane Hessen. I'm going to unmute her. She was the woman who was fortunate enough to spend some time with Ed on stage for us, but she's on our board. Diane, thanks for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Thanks, Warren, and thank you, David. This is really great. So here's my question. I went to business school with A.G. Lafley, who I'm sure you know well. A.G.
Very well.
For most of the 2000s, and he also spent his entire career at P&G. Mm-hmm. So my question is, what is it about the company that takes really talented individuals and keeps them for life? You know, is this intentional? And even more, is this still something that you think is possible in this new era where, as you call them, you know, achievement-oriented millennials think that staying in a company for 2 years is a lifetime?
Yeah, I'm absolutely convinced, Diane, that we will continue to see a number of people choose to work here for life. I recognize certainly the trends with millennials, but if I look at my current attrition is in the mid to low single digits. We have not seen a big increase in attrition. And to me, the challenge is we have to make the adult business deal an attractive one. So if you come into our company, the what we offer is a great opportunity to contribute right from day one, continuous development. And if you want to then exit at some point in time, you generally can do pretty well if you've got a number of years, and we're successful at P&G and people know that. But what's interesting, the number of people that have come from top MBA schools around the country and really around the world, because it's true in every country we operate, that say, I'm going to be here for 2 to 5 years to get Proctor credentials and jump. And then the vast majority don't. Some do, certainly, but a number choose to stay. And it's really if they find the combination of the career opportunities along with the quality of people they get to work with, and frankly, the quality of companies we get to work with. There's probably some folks on this call that they're either suppliers or professional service companies we work with. as P&G, I can pick up the phone and talk to virtually any company senior leader and get their help and advice, which is great. We can take a junior person. I do some recruiting at Duke where I went. And they'll say, but you know, what's different? I said, as a 2-year assistant brand manager, if you want to get on the phone and meet with people very accomplished at Google, Facebook, you name the company, it'll happen. It'll happen because of just Procter, Procter's brands, and frankly, the investment we spend in media. The last thing I'd say, and I use my career to illustrate, I'm an engineer out of Duke University. I started as a shift team manager in Greenville, North Carolina. I then moved 4 different places, was a plant manager in the late 80s. The company said, what do you want to do when you grow up? I said, I'd love to run a business. They said, good, start over in advertising. So I started over as an assistant brand manager with a Harvard and a Wharton MBA on each side of me, and then moved up through advertising. Then they said, if you really want to run, if you want to be involved in senior management, you need to live outside your culture and demonstrate you can grow a business. They sent me to Greater China, 3.5 years in Greater China, was the vice chair of a coalition of 70 companies working counterfeit, then sent me to Europe, then came back. So an engineer that started as a shift team manager is now the CEO and chairman of P&G because the company gives you opportunities. Where you start does not in any way be biased the odds against you to end up anywhere. That's a cool proposition to offer people, saying no matter where you start, if you have an aptitude and ability to deliver and work with people, you can end up all over the world in all kinds of businesses and all kinds of levels, which I think is still a pretty good proposition to offer people.
Yeah, and who's that? Sorry, I'm looking at our panel, and I think Todd Faber, you had a question a while ago that I skipped over. So let me see if you are if you're still here. I will see if I can get you, and then I will turn to Mr. Kraft. But Todd, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, absolutely.
Good morning. Thanks, Warren. Thank you, David, for coming out today virtually. You know, back in, I think it was June, you were quoted in Time magazine saying that far too often, the burden of seeking equality rests on the shoulders of the most marginalized, and this simply won't work. And of course, over the course of the conversation today, I think you've really kind of addressed what I was asking relative to how corporations can make that impact and recognize the importance of reaching out into the community to those who are marginalized to include them. But given the fact that over the course of the summer, there's been significant civil unrest and the reactions of certain parts of the government haven't been focused on the underlying cause, but rather on the unrest itself, where do you see corporations playing in this space to offset that?
Yeah, I really do believe that the companies, big and small business, will be a huge part of leading the change that needs to happen. My view is there is a societal awakening going on in the United States that I think is going to end up in a very good place, but it's going to be very bumpy. We're in the bumpy part right now. And I think companies, all of us, can play a role in first creating a great environment inside our company, i.e., are we hiring, developing, promoting, and creating what is truly an equal opportunity environment in our companies. And again, when I see the fact that it may have taken longer for an African American to move up to the second or third or fourth level, then I believe it's within our system that is the problem, not that broadly a group of people are not capable. Because we went back and looked at the scores, and I think it's true across many companies, is there are things that happen that we either unconsciously do or in some cases consciously do. If companies take the responsibility first in their own company to go out and hire, develop, and promote, number two, to use our spending power, we'll invest over $1 billion with minority-owned companies. We're going to increase that significantly. We're demanding of the advertising companies we work with. We want to see African-Americans and women and gay, lesbian, just a broad range of people behind the camera, in front of the camera, to depict the society we serve. 5 billion consumers buy a P&G product. And so I think we can do something within our companies. I think we can use our voice in P&G because we are a large advertiser. We've done those 3 films. We sponsored, many of you may have seen, Oprah special, Gayle King specials. You may have seen just a number of different documentaries that have been done where P&G will step up on those and play a sponsorship role. We'll support nonprofits that do it. But all of our companies can choose to do that. We can choose to kind of rationalize that somebody else needs to fix the problem, or we can step up and say, we play a role. And I don't for a second believe I or P&G has all the answers, but we're willing to put our shoulder against it and learn. And I give credit for Tim Ryan and the CEO Action for Diversity and Inclusion that he kicked it off. A number of us, including P&G, have been involved. I give credit to Ken Frazier at Merck, is working on an effort to try to hire a million black professionals and trying to get a coalition of companies that say we'll make commitments to invest. The Business Roundtable has an effort going there. Just there's just all kinds of opportunities, because I don't think we can leave it to government or others to address this problem. We employ collectively, you know, millions of people, businesses do, you know, big, medium, and small businesses. And frankly, in many cases, we're used to dealing with people, and we care about the people that we employ. We care about the people that we work with many of the partner companies. So I believe it is one we cannot just say they need to change. They is us. We need to create the opportunity. We need to be involved in education. We can do all kinds of things to help make sure that we help people get opportunities that they would not have gotten in the past. Even looking at our hiring systems and making sure we're not filtering out people that have tremendous capabilities but may not have had the opportunity to do some of the things that, that frankly, I was blessed to have the opportunity to do.
I mean, I continue to be pleasantly surprised and amazed with the sort of commentary that, that you and others have made along these topics lately. And so it gives me hope moving forward that that things are getting better, that, that people in charge and CEO positions who can actually enact change as opposed to hope and wish are doing there. And so it sounds like P&G is certainly doing a great job on that.
And I give credit to the P&G people. I've got an incredible team, and they came to me and said, we need to allocate, we put another $5 million to a take on race effort. How do we go out and support a number of different efforts with other partners, recognizing that it's going to take a broad coalition to make a meaningful difference? But we started with, and they asked me, we want you to stand on stage and talk about where we are as a company first. This was several years ago. Yeah. And we said, we're behind here. It's taking longer here. We showed all the data to our employees. And we said, and we can do better, and we need your help, but we're not going to ask you to do it. We're going to ask you to help us do it with you. And it's just been tremendous to me to see how people have stepped forward and said, yes, I got discounted. When they talked to the majority person, they said, you earned a promotion. When they talked to me and I got promoted, they said, we'd lean forward on you. And all those little things, are, you listen to them and go, you know, inadvertently, we do things that discount people. And if we listen on how they felt, not what we intended, but how they felt, we learn tremendous amount. Because I know we have great people. So if there's a problem, it's because something I or the broader system that I'm responsible for is getting in the way. And we'll fix it. We're working hard.
It really is. That makes me feel so good as we think about the future. I'm going to take one last question from our members, and then I'm going to go to our lightning round questions. But Linda Sloan Kay, you are up with a question. So I'm going to unmute you, and you're on. Linda, are you there?
I'm here. Sorry.
There we go.
Thank you, Warren. But Mr. Taylor, I wish you were my marketing professor many moons ago, because I have learned so much just from your talk. Thank you so much. So my first question is, are you sitting in your office or your bathroom? I can't figure it out. It looks like you have all your beauty supplies behind you, but is this your office?
Yes. That's what we make. So yes, this is my office. And this is my mask. So yes, I'm right here in the office.
So my second question is, which might be a difficult one to actually pinpoint you on, but what are the largest or what is your greatest profit margin category? Or at least if you don't want to state your largest or the top three.
The biggest ones in our company, and they're categories, fabric and home care. So you think about Tide, Downy, and a number of other brands we have are very big brands. They're in the many, many billions of dollars brands. Huge in the United States, but also huge worldwide. That's a big, big brand. Pantene and Head & Shoulders are two of the largest hair care brands in the world. They're both in the neighborhood of $3 billion in sales, and they're profitable businesses. And Gillette, the Boston-based business, is a beautiful business, and it's a very profitable business as well. And it's generally, one other one that most people don't realize is Charmin and Bounty are very big businesses. They're both market leading businesses. Bounty's over 40 share of all the paper towel bought in retail market are Bounty. And it's because Bounty are better. And generally, if you have a meaningfully better product, you're able to command a reasonable margin. And all those are probably some of the most profitable businesses because they're superior performing.
Thank you very much.
Certainly. Thank you.
Wonderful. All right. As has been our custom with these events, and we have about 12 minutes left, we've gone to what we call lightning round. I don't know if how quickly we get through them. But I've got a couple of questions that are, sure, more personal and less P&G. Would love your thoughts on. Let me start off with, what was your first paying job?
I started out as a rides employee at Carowinds, which is the theme park like Six Flags or Kings Island. And I worked there for 6 years. I met my wife there. I worked through high school and then college, spring, summer, and fall. I commuted from Duke 3 hours back to Charlotte in the spring, summer, fall working there because I was ended up being a supervisor of part of the park, the rides department. So it was a great summer job.
Oh, how much fun is that? You learned customer service, you met your wife, and had some fun. You didn't have to wear a costume or anything like that, right?
I did until I became a supervisor. That wasn't the best part about it. But once I became a supervisor, I could dress in clothes and act like I knew what I was doing. And I started at the strong rate of $2 an hour. And we've had some increases since then.
Yep. Excellent. It's I always find it amusing to find out first jobs and what people did. I've heard a lot of us, myself included, started off as delivering papers, but this is the first time I've had someone working at a park doing that. So that's good. What was the last book that you read that you would encourage our members to read?
There's a new book by Roger Martin. Some of you may know Roger. He was in New England for a while. It's called When More Is Not Better. And it's just come out, and Roger's done some work with us over time. He was with a strategy consulting firm and then was the dean of the Robbins School of Business for a while. But I've worked with Roger off and on for probably 20 years, and he's worked with our company even longer with AG. And the book is interesting because it comments on both democracy and capitalism and the role they play, and when things get a little out of kilter, what can happen. So I think it's a very timely book with what's going on broadly in society, and whether you agree or disagree with some of the things that he proposes, it causes you to think. And I like books that do that. It's relevant, it's contemporary, and it causes you to think about the role, frankly, that companies like P&G pay. You know, do you want to get the absolute most efficiency out of your manufacturing plant to the point that your manufacturing employees aren't getting a reasonable wage? I don't think so. But and its point is, many businesses have gotten to getting eked out the last bit of efficiency out of everything, and in many cases may have harmed some of the most important parts of your company, which is your people. So again, I think it's an interesting one. Roger Martin.
That's a good one. Totally personal. End of the day, let's call it a Friday. You're sitting out in your backyard, you're with your wife. What music are you listening to, and what's your guilty pleasure of food that you're eating?
The guilty pleasure is the easier one because I think about a song, but the guilty pleasure, I was just visiting my son who's in Charlotte. My wife and I went down there and we did a Shake Shack cookies and cream milkshake. I'm a very healthy eater, believe in exercise and staying fit, but the cookies and cream milkshakes at Shake Shack win the day. I don't even want to look at what the nutrition facts. I don't know if they can put nutrition facts on one of those, but it's good. On a music, there's not a specific artist. We listen to XM radio when we travel, and we have XM in the house, and we'll put it on a station that has more contemporary music, and just like to have it on, but not a specific artist. There's one interesting thing that I heard recently by an artist, not a music one, which is a lady named Siri Amani. I'm involved in United Way. We took the manifesto that we developed, which actually some of our marketing people worked with United Way, and she put it to a spoken word piece that I thought was just really cool. And it just sees, you just, she's a black woman that actually applied for a grant at United Way, and she did the spoken word version of the manifesto. And it just caused you to see the latent talent that exists all around you in our community, which is really cool.
And what's her name again? I want to write this down.
Siri Amani. Siri, I think it's S-I-R-I, Amani, I think it's A-M-A-N-I. It's really cool. Anybody involved in United Way, because she gives the message, but she does it in a very contemporary, a little bit more of a rap, spoken word type delivery. But it's just genuine. She was actually a benefactor of it and a gift for a garden in the inner city for her and other people. And said, we now own something. You know, I grew up in poverty, and she can speak about the impact United Way had on her life in such a genuine, powerful way. It's just great. You can write all kinds of cool things, do slick commercial. I listen to Siri Amani. I say, that's, I'll go work harder now.
That's fantastic. And I don't want to skip over your mention of Shake Shack. They opened up a spot here near campus at Boston College, much to my chagrin. I did go there once or twice and grabbed a shake and found myself a little bit less productive in the afternoon and a little bit more interested in going for a bike ride or playing basketball again. So, I share that is a guilty pleasure, certainly in the summertime. I am going to end this with a last question that I've asked all of our guests over the past several months. We've all struggled. We've all been isolated as we reach for community. But we also know that we're going to get out of this at some point, and we're getting out of this. And so my last question for you, as it is for everyone, is could you please share with us some message of hope, something that we can turn to while we're listening to some of the good works by Ms. Amani and we're having a shake, something that will give us the willpower to just keep going and to get through the days.
I'm actually very optimistic. I believe deeply in the power, frankly, and I think the U.S., but even the world, having lived around the world, the democracy we have is the best imperfect system in the world. The capitalist system we have is the best imperfect system in the world. And what is going to drive it to a good place over time is the humanity of people on this call, the leadership of, frankly, businesses, nonprofit organizations, educational institutions. And to me, I deeply believe in the good in most people. We see, unfortunately, featured at times bad things. But if you go around yourself, you know, the vast majority of things that we interact with are caring people that want to do the right thing and help other people. And part of what we need to do is we need to band together and practice one thing that I'd ask people to think about, which is positive gossip. In our world, it's culturally relevant to talk about what doesn't work. I believe one of the most powerful things we can do is to talk about what did work. I can think of so many stories, whether it's Siri Amani that does this thing, or the United Way, the new CEO of us in Cincinnati is doing incredible things, the head of the Free Store Food Bank that works tirelessly to help people that frankly don't have food. And I look at the people around me that work so hard to help me in a variety of different ways to do the job I do. You know, I benefit from standing on the shoulders of giants. Somebody mentioned A.G. Lafley and many others that taught me so much over time. And if we stay appreciative and then try to pass it and pay it forward, and then at the positive gossip, I get a chance to talk to some really cool people in Boston College Chief Executive Club. How cool is that? You know, you get to do things that many other people don't. And I believe in something Colin Powell said, which is, optimism is a force multiplier, because people look to the leader first to see how they should feel. They'll listen to your words, but they'll look at you. And if you're confident and want to make a difference and want to invest in them, they'll step up. But if they don't see that in the leader's eyes, not going to happen. You know, in many ways, we are the message forward. And if we can bring a message of hope, confidence, and content that's substantive, I think people will follow. And I believe we'll get out of this and we'll be a stronger country.
I think that's absolutely fantastic. And the concept of to use your term, positive gossip, you know, you've got an audience today of just under 100 CEOs, the men and women who are running organizations that are shaping New England and beyond. And I think that the message that you and Procter & Gamble has clearly embraced is something that I hope our members will go forth and share with others and talk about both the vision and ways that we can improve our society. And you know, there are a bunch of leaders on this call who are making a difference. And I think that is something that gives us optimism for moving forward. So I like that message of hope. Thank you for sharing it.
Thank you. I've enjoyed the chance to talk to you all, and certainly I appreciate what each and every one of you do to make a difference in. It's leaders like collectively all of us, along with the many talented people we get a chance to work with, that will make a difference.
So wonderful. With that, on behalf of Boston College and the Carroll School of Management, thank you everybody for joining our guest, David Taylor of Procter & Gamble, the chairman, president, and CEO. Once again, we appreciate your time in joining this community and keeping it strong, even though we have to do it by computers and webcams. Reminder, our next event will be on September 24th when Robin Hayes, the CEO of JetBlue, joins us. So until then, thank you. Keep buying P&G products.
There you go.
Stay in touch, everybody, and take care.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club, featuring David Taylor, Chair, President, and CEO of Procter & Gamble. To learn more about the Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management at Boston College, please visit our website at www.bc.edu/CEO Club.